Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi everybody, Flo here, just dropping in to tell you what you're about to listen to. This is Michael Taylor, author of the new book Impossible Monsters, in conversation with Unheard's very own Giles Fraser. At the Unheard Club just this week, they spoke about dinosaurs, religion, and the clash between science and faith, one that started in the Victorian era, but it's certainly not limited to the past. We thought it might be a fun Easter special to give you for the weekend, so we hope you have a festive break, and we'll see you on the other side.
Michael Taylor, you were four when Jurassic Park came out. What was it that made you want to write a book about dinosaurs?
I'm interested intellectually in culture wars. So my first book was about the abolition of slavery. So I'm a 19th century historian. That was the subject of my PhD. And what really interested me was how people tried to argue for slavery, how people tried to resist the campaigners such as Thomas Fuld Buxton and Thomas Clarkson, who were arguing for the abolition of slavery. And so whenever I say, well, I've now written a book about dinosaurs, a bunch of people just go, well, that's a very different thing. But in some ways, it really isn't, because, you know, it's the same period, it's the same intellectual battle between, to put them very broadly, forces of reaction and forces of progress.
Which is which, sorry?
We may disagree on this, but broadly speaking, I think I would put the scientists on the side of progress.
I see, okay.
Even if
just
they didn't
clear,
necessarily think clear. They were at the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so it's one of the tropes of the standard topics of doing an undergraduate degree, science versus religion or secularization. When did Britain become a secular society? So I did that. I loved it. And then with Bodley Head, I've had a chance to look at this, but to revisit the topic. And we're thinking about a way of how to tell the book. And so I begin to think, is there a way that I can bring dinosaurs into the picture? And the chronology really works. Not only that, but the cause and effect is there as well, which is quite important for any kind of history. So we begin in 1811 with Mary Anning, and many of you will have heard of, you know, an impoverished Dorset teenager, finding some very strange-looking bones on the beach outside Lyme Regis. Now, these aren't the bones of the dinosaur, because it's not for a while that we come up with the term dinosaur, and an ichthyosaurus, which is what Anning found, is a thunosaur rather than a dinosaur. But there is an instant shock there. You know, what the hell is this? We have never seen anything like this before. And then a few years later, she finds the plesiosaurus, which is basically the model for the Loch Ness monster. She then finds a dimorphodon, which is a pterosaur. Now, other places in England at the same time, other people are making similar types of discoveries. So there's a Sussex surgeon, Gideon Mantell, who finds the teeth of the iguanodon. The teeth look like those of an iguana, hence iguanodon. And in Oxford, William Buckland, who's a pioneering geologist, has finally pieced together lots of bones that have been found somewhere in the county over the past 150 years. He brings them together on the 20th of February 1824 and says, this is a megalosaurus, and we later call that the first dinosaur. So the 200th anniversary has just passed. That's pure coincidence. I didn't know this was going to happen whenever the book came out. It's actually quite good luck that he ended up calling it the megalosaurus, because technically the name should be the scrotum humanum, because whenever the thigh bone of the megalosaurus was first found in the 17th century, and it was illustrated in a book by Robert Plott and then by Richard Brooks, he thought that the end of the thigh bone looked, well, exactly like a scrotum humanum. So that could have been the name of the first dinosaur, but thankfully we've got something slightly more elegant.
So hang on a second. I just need to work something out. Given the fact that dinosaurs have been around for 10 million years or whatever it is, you'll tell me the number,
Well, they haven't been around for 66 million years.
OK, so, but presumably their bones have been coming up also for millions of years. OK, so how come in 1811 people will talk about discovering dinosaurs? Because presumably they have seen these bones for thousands and thousands of years.
They have and they haven't.
OK.
So the ancient Greeks and the Romans and other civilizations of the Near East and Central Asia knew dinosaurs. They just didn't know they were dinosaurs. They called them griffins and chimera and dragons and serpents because from the dry rocks of that part of the world which could preserve the fossils, they were finding these things. So people coming back from the Silk Roads to the Mediterranean were reporting about these strange and amazing things. And that's where a lot of those mythological creatures come from. There were other bones found in the Low Countries, some in France, some in Bavaria, some in North and South America. But it wasn't really until the 1810s and the 1820s in Britain that everything comes together and there's a critical mass for the development of paleontology. There's a couple of reasons for that. The first is that Britain has got the ancient universities and it's got the learned societies of London where people can discuss these things. The second thing is the Industrial Revolution. And that is a matter of luck, at least for the development of paleontology, because there is a real commercial interest in digging into the ground. So it's not a coincidence that a lot of these bones are found in quarries, and Britain's probably got more quarries than per square mile than anywhere else in the world at the time. So these things coming together, and whenever they start, there's a cultural prestige then attaches, and so there's a virtuous circle. Landowners begin to think, well, you know, I might find a dinosaur on my land, but at the same time, I might find coal, and that might be even better.
So you're from Northern Ireland, I'm guessing from Northern Ireland. And there's a famous chap from Northern Ireland who thought the world was 4,000 years old, Usher.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us about him?
So Archbishop James Usher was Archbishop of Armagh and Primate of All Ireland, the Church of Ireland, so Episcopalian, Anglican, in the 17th century. And he was an incredibly learned man. He hated everybody. And just wanted to spend time with his books. There are some great phrases about him just really resenting the fact that in his episcopal duties, he'd have to go and occasionally have dinner with somebody. He wanted to be in his library. And what really fascinated him, beside the early history of the church and the development of Christianity in Ireland, was piecing together the early history of the world. Now, people had tried to do this before. Usher was certainly not the first one to do it. And all the way back in the 11th century in China, Shen Kuo is doing it in the same way that a lot of ancient Greeks had even tried to work out by various means how old the world might have been. But Usher, rising through the episcopacy, has a lot of money from the rents from his farms, and he spends this all on books. So he's got agents in all the great literary cities of Europe and the Near East, getting every manuscript he can get his hands on. And so what Usher does, mostly during the Civil War, so he's in hiding as a royalist in Oxford, then in Cardiff, then at Donnet's Castle before going back to London, and he finishes writing his book at Charing Cross. He puts all of this together. So he works back through Greek history, Roman history, Persian history. He then goes into all of those really tedious verses in the Bible where X begat Y begat Z, and he works out 4004 BC, 23rd of October, round about 6 o'clock. That's the best I can do. And we might laugh at that, and I did for ages, but given the resources and the means of knowledge that were available to him at the time, it's an incredible feat of scholarship. And the reason that it sticks in the mind and that it became so dominant, certainly in the Anglophone world, is that by the middle of the 17th century, and then by the end of the 17th century, start of the 18th century, people begin to think about putting these dates in Bibles. And there's a new edition of the King James Bible, and there's the Bishop of Worcester proposes, well, let's put a date on the start of it. It goes 4004 BC, and that's where it sticks. Yeah.
There's an edition of the King James Bible with dates in it for that.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I've never heard that. That's amazing.
And that's where it comes from. And this is where it takes, it's 1670s it's proposed, 1680s, 1690s, these books are printed. That's an era of massive migration from Britain to the New World. And so people taking these Bibles and the establishment of a very, very Protestant society in America, that's where the primacy of the date of 4004 BC comes from.
How widespread is this? I mean, from Usher's study to...
So from Usher's study until... Well, there are people writing and traveling and conducting experiments, you know, the high years of the Enlightenment in the mid to the late 18th century. So Comte de Buffon, who was a famous French scientist, had heated up some iron and then tried to let it cool as a means of trying to work out, you know, when might the core of the Earth have been created and got to its current temperature. There's a Scottish traveller, Patrick Bryden, goes to Sicily, and he, with a Sicilian priest, are watching lava cool on Mount Etna. And they're realizing that, okay, if this eruption in this lava is only this much and Etna is this big, we need a lot longer to work with. But it's not really until the 1790s when there's a Scottish geologist called James Hutton who is looking intimately at all of the movements of rocks in certainly the Scottish lowlands and the Scottish coastline, where he proposes that actually, there's no vestige of a beginning here. We can't see when this began. Now, that's a pretty dangerous thing to say in the 1790s, because we might think of that decade and this era as the high point of a kind of radical secularism, but really it's not, and especially not in Britain, because remember, Britain's at war with France, and France is atheistic, it's secular, it's egalitarian, it's democratic. Britain is positioning itself as a conservative Christian bulwark against any of this. So if you're a British publisher and you're trying to reprint Tom Paine, and his Age of Reason in this era, you're going to prison. If you translate Voltaire into English, you're probably going to prison. And there's one school teacher who does this and dies in prison. Richard Carlyle, who's a free speech radical, is again doing this, and he's persecuted for seditious blasphemy. So
I want to wait for the culture wars. I just want to hold off the culture wars because we're getting into culture wars there. I want to just like see how we get to the culture war stuff through the dinosaurs. So we have this discovery on Chisel Beach or wherever it is. And how does this permeate? How does the shock waves of this discovery of these strange, impossible monsters permeate?
There are two intellectual trends occurring at the same time. We've got the discovery of all of these bones, and then we've got the development of a new and more radical form of geology. Charles Lyell, who's a Scottish barrister, hates the law. His eyes are shot, so he can't read anything. He just loves working in the field. He travels through the Auvergne, he travels down to Naples, and he works out or proposes to resurrect Hutton's theory about endless time and says, well, we can only really understand the world, the geology of the world, by reference to processes that are ongoing. And this necessarily means that these processes happen very slowly, very gradually, very incrementally, and that needs an awful lot more time than James Ussher has given us. There's been more than 6,000 years of this happening. Now, Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, which comes out in 1830, gets taken on a ship in 1831, which is called Beagle. And Darwin is reading it on the ship at the time. And he is seeing the same evidence with his own eyes. So he's walking around Tenerife and he's walking around the wreckage of Conception, where there's been a massive earthquake in 1835. And he's seeing fossilized evidence of marine creatures and shells high up in the Andes. And he's beginning to think, okay, right, something, Lyell might be right about some things here.
I mean, if you've only got 4,000 years, then you haven't got enough time for natural selection to do its stuff. But if you have millions of years, then you do have enough time. So it is a sort of, Lyell was a sort of laid the groundwork for what Darwin did in some way.
He definitely did. He wasn't necessarily happy with everything that Darwin suggested.
Okay.
But Lyell's uniformitarian geology and Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection are integrated together in this way. So Darwin then goes to the Galapagos on the same trip, and then he sees that on all of the different islands there are very, very slightly different types and species of animal or bird. So this all comes out, and all the while more dinosaurs are being found. There are more iguanodons. The Hylaeosaurus is found by Gideon Mantell in Sussex. Richard Owen, who's one of the coming man of paleontology and zoology in Britain, finds the Cetiosaurus. And in 1841, Owen coins the term dinosaur. Now, we might look at this in this idea of warfare between science and religion, and whether or actually not there is a war we should probably talk about because it's a bone of contention. The creation of the dinosaurs should, in some ways, have been a signal moment for the radical progressive idea of science and of the development of these creatures and how these creatures and the necessary geology maybe put an end to biblical literalism. But Owen's having none of that. It's actually done for exactly the wrong reasons or the opposite reasons. Owen hates the idea of the transmutation and the development of species, at least any change in species where God is not directing those changes. Owen believes in a divinely created archetype at the beginning of time, and maybe there's some kind of degeneration from that archetype, but God's in charge the whole time. Jean-Baptiste Lamarck is a very well-renowned French zoologist at the time, and he's suggesting that animals can change in their constitution in response to the demands of their environment. So the famous example is probably a giraffe elongating its neck so that it can reach the higher branches to feed, or the idea that a blacksmith will bequeath strong shoulders to his children. This is heretical in a number of ways, because it presumes that the Lord made mistakes at the start of time. You know, if the Lord had made everything perfect and in his own image when it came to man, then how could things have improved or progressed or developed in such a way? So Owen looks at the dinosaurs, these most stupendous and spectacular and sophisticated and complex beasts, and he says, well, if they were there at the beginning of time, if they were the best the world has ever had to show, then these theories of development and evolution must be bunk. So that's why he creates the term dinosaur, not to advance the system of paleontology or any of these theories of development, but to puncture them and to put an end to them. It didn't work.
It's very interesting. So I want to get into the culture war stuff now. It's very interesting. You mentioned William Buckland just a minute ago. I was very interested that you didn't say Reverend William Buckland when you mentioned his name, but you did say Archbishop Usher. So the baddies are reverends and the goodies are not. But
what I was trying to ask you is,
is it not the case that a lot of these people, because us vicars only work on a Sunday and we have a lot of time on our hands, and a lot of the people who were at the forefront of these discoveries were actually lazy clergy like me?
They weren't quite that lazy.
Yes, OK.
but no, you're right. William Buckland is an ordained Anglican clergyman. He's a Don at Oxford, which pretty much guarantees you're going to be an Anglican clergyman. Back in the day. William Conybeare is a really sophisticated geological theorist, and he is the one who announces the plesiosaurs. He's a clergyman as well. Gideon Mantell is a devout Christian. Mary Anning is a devout Christian. So for these early discoverers of dinosaur, there is no impossible or insuperable obstacle between reconciling the evidence of the Earth with what they believe. But that does presuppose a tension. So if there is new evidence arising from the bones, arising from the Earth, which causes them to try to shift their beliefs in what the early history of the world might have been, there is going to be that kind of epistemological clash between them. Buckland's hallmark is trying to reconcile those two. So whenever he gives his first lecture in geology at the University of Oxford, he calls it Vindicia Geologica, which is his means of saying, I'm still firmly within the classical, traditional, orthodox...
Vindicating geology in the face of...
And he then goes on to write one of the Bridgewater treatises, which are written in the early 1830s in order to prove the goodness of God and to reveal God's works in the natural world. And so for a lot of these people, and even Darwin as a young man, they are practicing natural theology. They are trying to understand the works of the Lord by discovering what he has done within the earth and around the world. But still, they realize that this is a dangerous thing, because even if they are taking this moderate approach, and they are trying to bring all of these things together in a coherent worldview, there are radicals on both sides who will have no truck with that. So there are scriptural geologists in the 1820s and the 1830s who are condemning people like Buckland as heretics. It's one of the reasons that Darwin spent a very long time trying to work out exactly how to articulate his theory. It's one of the reasons why Charles Lyell, whenever he published Principles of Geology, because he knew it undermined biblical history, had to put it out in a very particular way. He had to publish it as a very high-end book and get the approval of conservative established journals before he could publish it in a way that, you know, the ordinary man in the street could read it. Because the year before, Henry Hart Millman, who was a theologian and a poet at Oxford, had published a history of the Jews and the Israelites. And he had stripped that history, that Old Testament history, of any kind of majesty or divine presence. And he was almost run out of the university for it. He was nearly defrocked because of it. So there is a real cultural danger in all of these works, certainly in the early 19th century.
The way the story can be told is it can be told as if the only thing that's going on is going on within a mile of the Radcliffe camera. Okay, there's a way of telling that story.
There is, yeah.
But actually, that's obviously not true. There are things going on all the way around the world, all the way around Europe. And we're a part of something, this discovery of dinosaurs with regard to theology. of things that are going on in the University of Tübingen, for example. So there is all sorts of stuff about theology itself is changing at the same time. It's not quite that dinosaurs elbowed theology into the modern world, as it were. There are things that are going on at the same time.
No, you're quite right. There are all of these different threads happening, and I've tried to bring them all together in the book, and I think and hope the book is the first one to actually do all of this. It's a story of history, and it's the history of science and religion from the beginning to the end of the 19th century put together in one thing, with a leitmotif of
Strauss,
dinosaurs.
For instance, so, is going...
Certainly, yeah, Strauss, lots of the German higher criticism, as they call it, they are looking at the Bible, really minutely analysing the books of the Bible in all of the languages available to them. And, you know, they are slightly concerned. They realise that these are not historically reliable documents. They begin to speculate that whatever mystery or majesty there is a kind of projection of the authors at the time.
So they know, sorry, to excuse my French, but they've worked out that Usher is bollocks without having to find dinosaurs on Chisel Beach.
They have.
Yeah. Is that right?
I think that's fair. I think they realise that certainly the early chapters of Genesis, which purport to be history, are nonsense.
Yeah.
And I certainly think...
Well, they're not history.
Well, they could be wonderful and splendorous metaphors, yeah, but they are not an accurate history of the first couple of ages of the Earth. But then what happens is then all of this German theology is beginning to filter its way into the UK at the same time. And there's this idea of the Victorian crisis of faith. You know, did it happen? Did it not? I think there's a lot of people who are sincerely doubting. Somebody like James Anthony Froude is a very promising academic at Oxford in 1849. He writes The Nemesis of Faith, where he really excoriates the Bible and the God of the Old Testament in particular. I call him a fiend. You know, he gets, again, like Milman 20 years before, he gets run out of the university. But we have then in the mid-19th century we are now, a coalescence of a science which suggests another world and a critical analysis of the Bible, which are suggesting to an increasing number of people that the intellectual balance of power is shifting considerably.
So when you tell this story, what I loved about your book, which is brilliant, is that I've always known this story really through Darwin and, you know, not through geology, but through natural selection. And I can see actually there's a way of you tell this story about, you know, dinosaurs and geology being at least as important as Darwin for this particular crisis of 19th century faith. When you tell a story of natural selection and so forth, you're always having that debate with, you know, between the Bishop of Oxford about, you know, you descend from monkeys and all of that stupid debate that was had. Is there an equivalent sort of moment, if you're talking about geology, when... there was this sort of like this burst into the public consciousness, and this was a sort of like became a thing that everybody started talking about?
Well, if we're talking about paleontology and dinosaurs, I think the one moment where it's all brought out into the open is probably with the creation of the Second Crystal Palace. So the Great Exhibition in 1851, there's a debate at the end of it about what to do. So Britain is preeminent in science and industry. It would be a shame to waste all of this. It would be a shame to waste the palace. So the Brighton Railway Line buys the palace and shifts it all out to where Crystal Palace is now in Sydenham, southeast London, which by coincidence was just about to be connected with Brighton by the railway. And they put everything up again. And now for the first time, because it wasn't there in the original Crystal Palace, they decide we're going to make models of dinosaurs and we're going to make models of the other ancient inhabitants of the Earth. And so this becomes a real spectacle. This is something that everybody wants to go and see. And they fascinate Victorian children and teenagers in the same way that they did with me in the 1990s. In terms of how this then develops into something a little bit more punchy, into a popular cultural phenomenon, and how it really begins to turn the terms of debate with respect to evolution and natural selection, that waits on a few discoveries from Germany in the 1860s. So Darwin all the while is thinking about this idea of natural selection and evolution by natural selection. Alfred Russel Wallace is having very similar ideas at the same time. It's a dangerous idea because it can be applied to every kind of creature and it can be applied to humans. He runs the risk in his own mind of becoming known as the devil's chaplain by writing this book. But what they begin to find in Germany in the 1860s, first is the Archaeopteryx, which you may know is a feathered fossil, a feathered flying lizard. They then find the Compsognathus, which is basically a dinosaur that looks like a chicken. They then find in New Jersey the Hadrosaurus, which whenever they put it all together, must stand upright on two legs. And that's quite important because until then, look at the dinosaurs in the Crystal Palace, everything is walking on four legs. Everything is slithering along the ground. But now suddenly they're putting together all of these new fossils and they all stand on two legs. They all look a bit like birds. And so Huxley especially, maybe more than Darwin, so Thomas Huxley, his bulldog, the great communicator and propagator of science, takes everything together in the 1860s and says, if we want to... that's blasphemy.
We'll come to that in a sec.
So he, in the presence of Richard Owen, taking all of this American and Bavarian evidence and then applying Darwinian theory to it all, says for the first time, look, if you believe in evolution, and I do, look at all of this. We've got reptiles that are like birds, we've got birds that are like reptiles, and we've got gradations. We've got the intermediate steps. We've got the missing link in these chains of animals. And that is really the thing that begins, at least in Huxley's mind and his allies in Britain in the 1860s and 1870s, to prove the theory of evolution. Within a few years, the Bone Wars kick off in the United States. So two great paleontologists, Edward Drinker Cope and Othniel Charles Marsh, are out in the West looking for their own fossils. And they find loads of stuff. And they find all the dinosaurs that are now familiar names, the Diplodocus, eventually the Tyrannosaurus by Barnum Brown, the Allosaurus, the Stegosaurus. But they also find fossilized birds with teeth, and they find further reptiles with feathers. And so Marsh, who buys into Darwinian theory completely, meets the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Nashville in the 1870s and says, look, we've got it down pat. We've proved this. Evolution is true. And the way that we've got there is by looking at crocodiles, birds, dinosaurs. They're all the same family. And they are. Dinosaurs and birds are the same. Birds are dinosaurs.
I'm a clergyman, okay. I look at all this stuff and say, yeah, this is obviously true. So I need to sort of inhabit a very different mental world in order to see it as a crisis, okay. And when I look at contemporary atheists like yourself, okay, what I tend to think is you're a version of the sealed knot, okay. You like to recreate old battles that you won. Okay, you're recreating old battles that you won, and that good for you. But tell me why I should care.
Okay, well, to move back a bit, the idea of there being this incessant eternal warfare between science and religion is very old. It's also a bit hackneyed. We might agree on that.
Yeah.
It is created in 1874 by John Tyndall, who's an Irish physicist. And hates what the Catholic Church has done in Ireland, by Andrew Dixon White and John William Draper, who are two Yankee Protestant scientists who loathe the idea, again, about the Catholic Church, that religion has stopped the progress of humanity and the progress of science over the previous 100 years. The idea that there are these two monolithic figures that are having an eternal fight between each other, that's pretty passé. I address that in the book. But there is... there's a constant intellectual tension that occasionally flares into a battle rather than a warfare, and there is a culture war. There's a battle for control of science through the 19th century. If we look at you mentioned at the start, and we said they're all clergymen, they're all devout Christians, and you can't really practice science without regard either to the church or to some kind of religious belief. So what we have over the course of the 19th century, which is G'd up by theories of evolution and discovery of dinosaurs and the development concomitantly of all of these different sciences, is a fight for the right to practice science without having regard to religious dogma. So Huxley and eight of his allies in 1864 found the X Club. They call it the X Club because they couldn't think of a better name. But the idea is that they will try to propagate a form of scientific practice which is literally secular. It is apart from religion.
The Royal Society is the same, isn't it? You can't mention God in the...
That's very true. But they are looking at the Royal Society at the time and thinking this is a bastion of the old orthodoxy.
Wow.
These are tired old men who are not practicing science properly, and we want to wrest control of British science institutions from them. Okay. Now, you have Huxley on the one hand, who is the coming man, the coming force in British science at this time. Richard Owen, who we mentioned earlier, is a grim captain of orthodoxy. He was the kind of guy who enlisted in the Royal Artillery Company whenever the Chartists threatened to riot. He is devoted to conservative politics and to the Christian religion. He hates the idea of scientific processes such as natural selection taking place without the interposition of a divine being. So we have Owen and Huxley tearing chunks out of each other all the way through the 1860s, in particular about whether or not theories of natural selection can be applied to gorillas, to other primates, and to the human species. Huxley wins, I think, on points, mostly because he begins to take a lot of informed opinion with him. Even Charles Lyell comes around. Charles Kingsley writes The Water Babies as a satire of Owen and the unyielding orthodoxy of the time. He founds Nature in 1868. He founds the Royal College of Science. There is the development of this scientific practice apart from the old strictures.
Maybe I'm wrong about this because I'm not a historian, but I always think that people write history books to tell us something about today. That may be my grand fantasy and so forth. And if I'm right about that, what is it that this book about 19th century discussions about? I suspect there is not somebody in this room who believes that the world is 4,000 years old. Okay, so why does this matter today?
As I've said earlier, I'm interested in these kinds of intellectual conflicts. I'm interested in how people change opinions and how evidence can force people to change opinions or how people reject evidence. So, you know, if my first book was about how do you win a political campaign, how do you change people's minds morally, ethically, politically over something that we would now regard completely fundamentally as an evil, which is slavery, this book is about how we change people's minds over the course of a much longer period, over the 60 or 70 years, about something pretty fundamental about how the world actually works. Now, if we wanted to boil that down into a point about today, it's just another fight about how do we present evidence? How do we present evidence persuasively? What do we do when people reject it in preference to an ideology? I think that's an age-old question. It's one that continues to interest me and will probably infiltrate all the different books that I will write. But I don't see this as just a relic of the 19th century.
No.
This is something that happens over practically every kind of epistemological change in human history. It's just that this one's got dinosaurs.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We have heard a lot about culture wars and about how science reacted to the news of the dinosaurs. How did the church respond? That's my interest. What was the response of the religious establishment and of people of religious faith?
Thanks. So there is a concern all the way through this period, and especially in the mid-century, that the church is just not keeping up, either intellectually or physically. Britain had transformed remarkably over the previous 70 or 80 years, whereas once it was a rural agrarian country where people farmed or maybe mined, it was now the workshop of the world. People lived in cities and towns or worked in mills and factories. And one of the consequences of this is that there simply wasn't anywhere near enough space in the churches for the people. Because if Manchester has gone from being a small village to, you know, one of the greatest urban wonders of the world in the space of 50 years, there's no way there's going to be enough space in the churches for them. So the religious census of 1851 paints something that could be regarded as a fairly bleak picture, but the church does respond. It's often missed out, or it should be, you know, people should be reminded that actually, in terms of crisis, you know, during the Crimean War, during the sickness of the future Edward VII, people still went to prayer. People still fasted. There were days of thanksgiving for all of these things. So there was still a religious core to society all the way through this. And how the church does respond, and actually responds the most effectively, I think, is that from the 1860s, 70s, 80s onwards, it develops new ways of creating communities and bringing people within the religious fold. Now, this is not to say that they're creating religiosity at the same time, because that, I think, has to be an internal process. But through muscular Christianity, they are creating an ethos whereby people can play games, they can play sports, they can be active, useful subjects of the empire at the same time as participating in the Anglican Communion. And it's no coincidence that I think from the 1870s and the 1880s, as organized team sports begin to take off from Britain, that you have the churches at the very center of that movement. So it's not the same as getting people devoutly sitting on church pews three times a day, but if you have them within a church environment, boxing or playing cricket or playing football, that's better than nothing. So the church transforms what it is from this font of all authority into a source of community and morality by the end of the 19th century. And I think at least three Premier League clubs this year, Man City, Everton and Fulham, all began as church teams. The YMCA is probably one of the most successful.
More than those three.
At least.
Way more. Birmingham, there's loads that did. Yeah. Aston Villa was a church. Was the church team. And I did actually. We haven't met before, but we texted each other the other day, and I looked through Michael's Twitter feed, and I discovered a mutual love of football and a mutual loathing of Liverpool Football Club. And
it's been bringing people together for 150 years.
When does the general population really start to accept, or at least to know about, the dinosaurs, and that there is an alternative to what the church line, the biblical line, was about the origins of the earth? When does the actual population, not the intellectuals, but the population, start to understand this?
Mine's a bit of a follow-on, actually, to that question, which is like, when do things go from being huge controversies to being utterly absorbed into the sort of the fabric of society? And why do we forget? Like, what is the forgetting, and how quick is that forgetting? Is that a generational thing or a couple of generational things? Like, there are such huge scandals and new waves of knowledge, yet it becomes clearly deeply absorbed so quickly that we forget. This is like wonderful, this talk, because it feels like so shocking, these dinosaurs versus religion. I think we're facing certain things right now, without going into the culture wars, how does that get absorbed deeply into the bones of a culture?
The Crystal Palace is really important in that. It brings, you know, a physical demonstration of the dinosaurs to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people from 1853-54. A really important development is the 1870 Education Act, which expands elementary education massively in Britain. And at the same time, you have improved technology, which means that people can print many more books and pamphlets and newspapers much more quickly. Round about the same time, the final taxes on knowledge, the final duties on newspapers, are lifted. So from the 1870s and 1880s, you have much more popular science being published. You have lots of illustrations and engravings of dinosaurs being put into those books. The Illustrated London News is a really important development. You've got lots of people reading that every single week. Images of dinosaurs. People are going to lectures and taking the slides or the images from those lectures and putting them back into the newspaper. So we have, by the end of the 19th century, it's still not a completely literate society, but it is a much more literate place than it had been in the 1810s and the 1820s. And we do get a popular demand for science and for dinosaurs. And the great apogee of this happens at the turn of the 20th century when you get probably one of the few great adventure stories of all time, which is The Lost World, which is about the discovery of dinosaurs which have suddenly survived in South America. You then have some of the very first animations being shown in cinema theatres are of dinosaurs. So they're there at the very beginnings of those popular culture phenomena, and I think in some way they helped to create them.
How much is this debate over dinosaurs, the culture war over dinosaurs, actually a sort of cipher for a debate over politics, over like broader politics? You're not really talking about science and religion. What you're really talking about is continental politics or the anxiety of socialism or all of this sort of stuff.
That's a really, really good point because, you can draw a line down the list of characters in this book and in this story. And there are Tories, Conservative, Anglicans, Orthodox on one side, and you will have Whigs, Liberals, Unitarians, Dissenters on the other. It's not a coincidence that somebody... So the two people on the Beagle Voyage, to give you the example, who've written really good records of it, Darwin, from a prominent abolitionist family who develops a theory of evolution by natural selection. Captain Robert Fitzroy gets back, and in his Beagle Journal, he writes about Noah's Ark being found on Mount Ararat, and he's pro-slavery. So that's a crude but, I think, useful example that there can be...
They didn't go anywhere near Mount Ararat on Beagle, did they?
I'm sure that was to Fitzroy's regret. But
that's in Anatolia, that's in Turkey. They went nowhere near there.
No, but he was appending to his voyage diary stories about the patriarchs and Noah's Ark being found among Ararat,
okay.
which were completely inconsequential to the actual story, but he put them in there anyway. But yes, there's a real problem that lots of political conservatives have with the theories of evolution by natural selection. Because evolution by natural selection necessarily does not involve divine interposition. There's no God there. Or at least one reading of the theory says there's no God there. So if all of these organisms and all of these species and all of these animals can develop and can improve on their own merit without God being there, without an order or a superimposed order, they're looking at the same time at the Chartists and nascent socialism and feminism. And all kinds of 19th century political radicalism. And although Britain is relatively immune from the worst excesses of it, those fears are still there. And they see in materialism, which is the scientific idea that matter has this innate energy, a real danger to the social order, because they begin to think that if the lower orders can actually look after themselves and can improve themselves without our supervision, well, what is there to separate them from us? And that's one of the real dangers of evolution, at least politically. One of the most remarkable things about Darwin's publication of The Descent of Man, which is in 1871, 12 years after The Origin of Species, and even about the publication of The Origin itself, is that there is this pent-up fear that he's going to ruin his reputation and that he's going to be dragged across the coals and branded as a heretic and the devil's chaplain and all of this stuff. The reaction to Darwin directly is relatively muted. Okay, people like Richard Owen write these incredibly acerbic and aggressive reviews anonymously, which gives you some indication of Owen's character. But he's pretty remarkable, or he thinks it's pretty remarkable, that there's silence in some quarters. I mean, it's certainly within the intellectual coterie with which he might socialize or who might read these books. There has been groundwork laid over the years, not by Darwin himself, but by his allies who knew about his thinking, by other scientists and other naturalists who had been looking at dinosaurs or looking at geology, implanting these seeds and acclimatizing people who would read these books. And so the implications and the sudden implications of what Darwin then wrote aren't as shocking as they might have been. So how quickly we forget these things and how quickly we just accept them, the world moves much faster now than it did in the 1850s and the 1860s. But there's certainly, you know, cycles of debate and cycles of generation or generational debates that kind of wipe the slate clean. It was 10 or 15 years in this period. We might think about something completely different next year.
So just wondering how much effort there was to not throw the baby out with the bathwater, but to integrate science and religion. You've kind of touched on it a bit, but I guess the Old Testament book of Job talks about monsters. So did people use that to try and bring it together?
So the first epigraph in the book is that itself, I think. If I could find it, that would be useful. But yeah, beholdeth now the behemoth which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. Lo, now his strength is in his loins, and his force is in the navel of his belly. His moveth his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his stones are wrapped together. His bones are as strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. He is the chief of the ways of God. So it's a lovely piece of prose. And there is some attempt to reconcile the biblical monsters with the fossils that we're finding in the earth during this period. But I will say that even Huxley, who, you know, is likely to bring Giles out in a rash because of his reputation as the most fiercest prosecutor of the culture war and certainly of the guerrilla war against Richard Owen, he's not an atheist. He's an agnostic. He follows evidence, and if the evidence suggests that God is not directing the natural world, then that's what the evidence suggests. But he despises the idea of certainty. And that's literally what agnostic means. It is the antithesis to gnosis, to knowing. And he says whenever he's devising a new school curriculum for London, okay, I'm not going to stop biblical studies because you teach useful morality. He literally says he's not going to chuck the baby out with the bathwater. That's the phrase he uses. So there is, even at these extremes of the culture war, there is a kind of reconciliation or a recognition of the utility of the opponent's mores.
So we've spoken mostly about the representations of the world that was provided by the church. And I wonder whether the fact that it's been undermined itself also undermines maybe the moral principles within the church. Can these things be separated?
So I wanted to ask you about dinosaurs today, because if you listen, by the end of the 19th century, everything should have been resolved. And yet today we have a lot of people that do not believe in evolution. So what about the dinosaurs today? But it also doesn't seem like the culture war is the same, because it's not so much that it's the church actively pushing. It seems like it's a little bit of a diverse group of people.
There are some very batshit crazy people who still maintain that, as it were, God planted the... Can you rehearse some of those extraordinary arguments that people still...
Well, I'll give you some autobiography. Whenever I was growing up in Ballymena in the 1990s, in Ballymena, if you've ever heard of it, is either because of Ian Paisley, rugby, or heroin abuse. sorry if anyone from Ballymena is watching this online. In the 1990s, I couldn't go to the play park on a Sunday because everything was chained up. The rock band ELO was forbidden from playing a gig in the town for fear that they would spread devilry among the town's youth. You know, there is still a hardcore religious fundamentalism in many places in the UK. It's one of the reasons, actually, I became interested in science as a kid and in the apparent disparity between these things. In the middle of the 19th century, there is this idea of Philip Henry Goss. He's not in the book because it was so batshit I didn't really want to put it in. He writes in a book called Omphalos the idea that actually everything was made all at once and that God deliberately buried the dinosaur bones and the fossils hundreds of feet underneath the earth.
Yeah.
You may well have seen on the internet that in Kentucky they have built a life-size model of Noah's Ark and there are dinosaurs in it because apparently that's where they were saved. There is an awful lot of nonsense, and I think the terms and at least the parameters of our debates now have narrowed considerably. I think that there's just so much of a greater authority given to science and to evidence and empiricism, regardless of the debate, that those extremes are probably cut off from the terms of discourse. With dinosaurs today, I guess the next big thing to get people's head around is that, birds are dinosaurs. They are literally dinosaurs. They are from exactly the same family biologically, which we would argue, or at least I would argue, and paleontologists would argue, is living proof of that evolution of creatures from 65, 66 million years ago, whose eggs survived the apocalypse in the ground, and birds thereafter flourished and survived. Going back to the first question, which was, I think, about the potential disconnect between the strength of the church and the strength of religion as a font of morality. The church was willing, I think, tacitly, very quietly, to yield ground in terms of its ability to represent the natural history of the world with authority. It found itself, a niche is too small a world, but it found itself a much more cultural place, or a much more accommodating place within the national culture, as something that could provide succor and ethical guidance and a form of morality to people. And I think that was a necessary compromise to make, because it wasn't going to win the evidential battle. There was enough of it, and there was enough of it that was persuasive, that maintaining that the world had been created in 4004 BC on a Saturday evening, that would have been nonsense. And lots of people by the early 19th century knew that was nonsense. But by yielding that, I think it actually empowered itself a little bit further to still provide that kind of pastoral leadership that Giles and many other people will still give today.
It feels to me, anyway, that New Atheism tried to sort of weaponize this debate that you have cast in a more nuanced way. Do you think that period, which I think is probably past, was not a good lens through which to see this particular period?
I think the period of New Atheism, so if we're talking about the noughties, really, that decade of the God delusion and Dennett and Harris, the Four Horsemen, as they were called, and I read them all as a kid. I probably agreed with some of what they wrote as a kid. They all approached the subject from very different perspectives and with very different ideals. Some biological, some psychological, some philosophical, some explicitly political. And they've all gone in very different directions now. And you might find them right now on the right wing, if we can put it that crudely,
correct,
of a lot of culture war issues, which would certainly not have been the case in the early 2000s.
I mean, Sam Harris defending torture and all this sort of stuff. I mean, this is not the... So when you talk in the... when you talk in the 19th century about the church being, as it were, on the right, and the atheists being, as it were, on the left.
Everything is relative to what's
happening
at the time.
So that's not necessarily been recreated in the early 21st century.
No, I think a lot of the new atheism was quite extreme in what it said, and it was often written quite well and articulated very persuasively. But I think certainly its most... notorious is wrong, its most persuasive proponents were addressing certain issues with a degree of extremism which has become apparent in the other issues to which they now address themselves. And therefore, if we were to take the approach that they adopted 15 years ago to the period of history that I've written about, we would find a very, very different history being written. And I'm not sure it would be a better one.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in putting your hands together for Michael Taylor? Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, good boy. No, very good, very good.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.